Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, what Michael Cohen means for Donald Trump. And Richard, we are recording this the day after the news broke that Michael Cohen, President Trump's longtime personal lawyer, pled guilty to 8 different charges. The one that's getting the most attention is over an excessive campaign contribution, improbable as that may sound. This is about the hush money that Cohen paid in the immediate run-up to the 2016 election, apparently at Donald Trump's behest, to buy the silence of Stormy Daniels over the affair that she seems to have had with the president. And Richard, I guess we should probably start small with this and build out. The people who are gunning for the president are treating this as a watershed. You've got his lawyer pleading guilty to a crime that directly implicates the president. It's been suggested here that obviously this was Cohen doing this at Trump's behest. We do have a decent analogy for this in a case from about 10 years ago where John Edwards, who was a Democratic candidate for president, was also moving money around to keep a mistress from coming to light. Edwards was acquitted on those charges. So let's put aside for a moment all the extra issues that attach to this because you're talking about a sitting president. We can come to those in a moment. But just on the merits of the case, I mean, let's engage a simpler hypothetical in which Trump lost and this came to light. How hard would it be to get a conviction in a case like this?
Well, I mean, the first thing you have to do is to ask yourself the following question. What credibility do you give to the plea that Cohen makes? It is entirely in his interest under these circumstances to cut a deal in which he basically does the president in an effort to reduce the sentence that he receives. So the way in which he characterizes this is he says that I paid money directly on the order from the president in order to stifle this inquiry, which was about a campaign issue. Now, suppose it turns out that somebody wanted to put him under cross-examination, and the questions would then come fast and furious. Did the president use the words, please pay this money in order to make a quiet for Ms. Daniels to help my presidential campaign, or did he say something else? Everything that Cohen says, which implicates the president, is essentially at this particular point untested by anybody else. He has a very strong motive to lie, as does the president, if the president happened to tell something wrong. So to sort of treat this admissions as though it's proof of the allegations that are contained in there is wildly premature. If this had gone to trial and the same allegations had been made, and now it turns out that Cohen was trying to defend himself, under those circumstances, it would be a very, very different case. He'd start denying things. And if Trump, in fact, is going to be confronted by Cohen as a witness in some kind of proceeding, impeachment or whatever, the amount of cross-examination would be absolutely furious on this particular point. Cohen is an admitted and a known liar, a fix-it man and everything else. And essentially, in the case where one person's word is against somebody else's word, I do not think under those circumstances that anybody can form a premature judgment on this. There may be some tapes about this, which would be very, very clear. But let me at least put one fact on the table, which seems to cut in Trump's favor. This was a situation where Cohen advanced his own money to pay this woman off and then later sought reimbursement from the president. That sounds as if he acted on his own initiative to make the payment and then went back to the president saying, look, I've done you a favor. You now have to kind of pay me the money back because I've worked for you for so long, whether or not you authorized it. That is a perfectly plausible scenario under that circumstances. If now, in fact, what happens is the president repays Cohen, that does not look like a campaign contribution. The campaign contribution looks like the money that Cohen sent out on his own initiative. This is an area in which, to say the least, the law would be extremely gray. My own friend Bob Bauer, on a different situation, says this is not the kind of thing that has ever been prosecuted with respect to campaign finance laws. And so the president has another shot that he can put forward, which is you're going after me under a set of rules that you've never applied to anybody else.
Okay, so now let's turn to those complications that arise from this being a sitting president. and work under the assumption that there is, you know, a better case to be made, that there's something you can bring him up on. Richard, explain where the debate currently stands on the question of whether or not a president during his term in office can be indicted.
It's interesting. There was not much of a debate about this at any point in time, because the explanations are so powerful. Suppose you have a sitting president, and suppose this man can be indicted. Whom can he be indicted for, and for what kinds of offenses? If you don't have official immunity, absolute immunity based on office, then any single prosecutor in the United States at the federal level can surely indict him for any kind of offense, whether or not it's related or unrelated to the presidency. And it's probably the case that under state law, he could be indicted as well. So that, for example, if New York State, which is running an investigation of the Trump Foundation, decided that there were serious financial irregularities, they could indict the president. Now, once the guy is indicted, what's the next thing that you have to do? Do you put him in jail? Do you require him essentially not to leave the country or the jurisdiction? Do you put a belt upon him so that you could watch his every movement? And can you have hundreds of people, or at least dozens, or even three people doing this? I think the answer is no. And so the correct view, I think, on this question, which is still Justice Department policy, and which people thought about first with Richard Nixon and then with Bill Clinton when they got into trouble, is you could make them unindicted co-conspirators. There may be some way to get evidence from them about certain things when they are unindicted co-conspirators. But the risk of multiple indictments, which would paralyze the office, means that you can't do it. An indictment is done unilaterally by a single prosecutor. Nobody else can stop that. An impeachment requires that you get the cooperation of a majority of the House of Representatives. And at that particular point, at least under the Constitution that was originally designed, judicial review was not a settled or even well-established institution in the sense that it means that the Supreme Court could tell other branches of government what they could and could not do. Judicial review was widely understood to mean probably just this, which is the Congress could not force on the Supreme Court that it take cases that were not within its constitutional jurisdiction. That's what Marbury and Madison was actually about on its fact. So this thing would go entirely inside the Congress, with the prosecution being done by the House and the Senate doing the actual judgment. And one of the reasons why we're perfectly confident that the Supreme Court would never get involved in any portion of this is that the Chief Justice, of course, presides over an impeachment trial of the president. Bill Rehnquist did that when Bill Clinton was, in fact, impeached. And how could you now say that you could somehow or other go back to the Supreme Court, one of whose members is disabled because he's sitting on the impeachment situation? So I think that the answer is, in terms of the impeachment, that has to take place. And I do think as part of that impeachment, it's not settled, but I'm pretty confident that you could demand that the president turn over documents and subpoena them and cross-examine him or whatever in that context, which you could not do otherwise. But as to any individual indictment, I think what you can do is as follows. I think you could demand that papers be preserved. I think that it is possible under these circumstances to say that we have to toll the statute of limitations. You cannot say, oh, there's a 3-year statute of limitations and then wait 4 years. If the president takes advantage of his office, as he surely should, then in effect, the statute of limitations picks up again only after he leaves office. I don't think in general that you can get a deposition of the president. I thought that was incorrect in the Clinton case. If you can get it, it would only be under circumstances where you have very, very strong evidence that he's done something wrong independently, which might have been what the situation was in the Nixon case with the tapes, where the White House was in up to its eyeballs very much from the early time. Whereas in this case, they have yet to establish in either the Cohen case or in the Manafort case that there was any connection with the Russia investigation, which started all of this. So my own sense about all of this is that there can be no indictment of a sitting president, period. And all the other stuff you can't do either. So if in an indictment you can start to demand that people surrender papers and things like that, you cannot do this. What you have to do is to preserve the status quo, because once the president is out of office, all the institutional concerns disappear. And at that point, you can pick up on the indictment kind of issue. The documents are still there, and you can still demand discovery, by asking the president to answer interrogation. And at that point, of course, he has his Fifth Amendment privileges.
Richard, on the day that we're recording this, Mazie Hirono, who's a Democratic senator from Hawaii, canceled the meeting that she had scheduled with Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to be the next justice on the Supreme Court. And she did so on the grounds, I'll just read from her quote here, I am canceling my appointment with Judge Kavanaugh because I choose not to extend a courtesy to this president who is an unindicted co-conspirator of meeting with his nominee. Now, we know that Democrats are anxious to pull out all the stops they can to keep Kavanaugh from being confirmed. You could imagine this easily becoming sort of a talking point for them. How intellectually defensible is this position?
Very weak. First of all, the president in this case is not an unindicted co-conspirator. He's somebody at whom Michael Cohen has pointed the fingers. And in the Richard Nixon case, it's exactly what happened. He was an unindicted co-conspirator, precisely because he was part of the conspiracy, but everybody respected the view that there was, in fact, absolute immunity from prosecution by private parties. It had to go to impeachment. And once that started, the president just folded and he left office rather than to face a trial in which conviction was, I think, pretty certain. So I think that's different. The second thing about it is, at this particular point, the matter is before the Senate. And what they are really saying is, if the president is an unindicted co-conspirator, it's not they're not going to just talk about Kavanaugh. They're not going to talk about any nomination of any person for any office so long as he is called an unindicted co-conspirator. And that could bring the government to a complete halt. The person who's in charge of this, of course, is Senator McConnell from Kentucky, who can push the issue whether she wants it or not. In terms of the substance of the question, I've heard people make the claim that the reason you have to do this is because it turns out that Kavanaugh might sit on a case which involved the president. Kavanaugh was on record in 1998 taking the position that I just said about you cannot indict a sitting president. That was in connection, one might remember, with Bill Clinton and the various travails that he had. But my view is, if you're worried about that, the only issue is, when it comes, does the president do something that Mr. Kavanaugh now thinks requires him to recuse himself from the particular case? And it's very, very difficult to figure out exactly what that thing would be. If the argument is that he is going to be beholden to the president because the president nominated him, that's going to be an argument that applies even worse to the second person who's nominated. So what she's saying, in effect, is that there will be no nomination so long as this president essentially is under a cloud. That brings the government to a halt. I think, in effect, the Democrats have been little short of scandalous in their effort to pile allegation against allegation against Kavanaugh. He's a perfectly credible, rather distinguished jurist. What they don't want to do is to see the control of the Senate in the hands of conservative justices. If they were to say just that, I think it would be perfectly fine. But I think all this other stuff is just indefensible window dressing under the circumstances. And I think if she doesn't want to meet with him, that's fine. But note what the peculiarity is. First, you don't want to meet with him for these kinds of reasons, or we don't like him. And then you say, well, we don't want to meet with him, but at the same time, we want to rummage through thousands upon thousands of documents which have no relevance to this case to find out what the true Brett Kavanaugh is about. I think the simple explanation, the best way you find out what Kavanaugh is about is to sit down and talk to him. And they won't do that. So they're not interested in information. They're interested in obstruction. And I mean, at least when the Merrick Garland thing came up, McConnell said, we control the Senate. And frankly, we do not want this man to tip the balance. We're not going to engage in defamation. We're just not going to hold hearings. If you look at the existing law on that question, the Senate can decide collectively to confirm or not to confirm any presidential nomination. There is no reasonableness, just cause requirement. It's a straight kind of political struggle one way or another. If the Republicans had the presidency and the Democrats had the Senate and they wanted to stonewall the way in which Mitch McConnell did, they would be perfectly within their rights.
Last thing that I'll ask you, we're hearing renewed talk, mostly from Democrats, about the president, the theory here being that the walls are closing in on him, potentially trying to fire Bob Mueller or fire people in the Justice Department if they won't fire Bob Mueller. There have been efforts that have not yet gone anywhere in Congress to enact legislation preventing that. They seem to be getting a second wind right now, though nothing that looks close to passage. Give us the legal analysis there. To what extent could Congress wall off that possibility?
I think the answer is it's probably illegal. We have a fairly strong tradition in this country at the presidential level that all the people in the executive branch at high levels serve at the pleasure of the president. This is not by virtue of congressional grace. This is by virtue of structural implications that we make when we talk about separation of powers and checks and balances. And it's the separation here that tends to dominate. The check that the Senate has on the president is if he decides to fire Mueller or decides to fire Sessions, they can refuse to confirm any subsequent nominee that he wants to put into place and leave him somewhat crippled with an acting this or an acting that under the circumstances. But I do not believe that they can essentially do that here, because then you have to ask the next question. If they can do it under these circumstances, can they then say he cannot fire the Secretary of State because of any kind of political differences unless he gets our blessing? So that means he's saddled with Rex Tillerson when he'd rather have somebody else replace him, Mom Pompeo. So I think the answer is they cannot do this thing. And I think that they should not try. They're asking for a struggle. The president, I think, can fire. I think they're going to try to argue if you fire in violation of a statute of this sort, that becomes an impeachable offense. You must remember that when you go back to the Lincoln situation and Andrew Johnson, the whole situation with Stanton, who was then Secretary of War, was the question of whether or not it could be made illegal to fire the Secretary of War, now defense, because of some political differences. And I think the answer to that question then and now is no. You cannot do it. Your checks come in other forms having to do with the confirmation of a successor. So, I mean, what I find so tragic about all of this is that what was reasonably well understood and settled constitutional law on difficult points has now been thrown up because everybody on the Democratic side wants to change the rules in order to get Mr. Trump. I don't want to be understood as to saying that this is the slightest bit of support for anything that he has done politically. That is simply not on the table at this point. The question is some abstract president being checked by some abstract Congress. The Trump element has to drop out of the equation, because if it does not, then every single set of constitutional rules that you have will be tailored to the particular personality of this, that, or the other official. And when you get such an outsized personality as Donald Trump, the tailoring is going to be highly specific. So I think the final lesson that I would say in this case is that you have to go with the ordinary principles of justice when the going gets toughest. And the most dangerous thing that you can do is to try to change on the fly the constitutional rules in order to let somebody get at somebody whom they don't like. And the real danger is not with the current Congress, but after November, Lord knows which way the distribution of power is going to go. But I do think it would be completely inappropriate, given the record as we have it today, to try to institute impeachment against Donald Trump for what happened in the Michael Cohen case.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas@hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.